Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Joining me as usual in the studios of CBS Interactive, Fleischmann Hillard's VP of Digital Media, Scott Rohde.
Hi, Tim.
This week's regular guest commentator is Starcom boss Bob Gooch.
Good morning.
While our guest today is Damien Borshok, MD of Interbrand.
Good morning.
This week, the world's biggest brands, the leaked Fairfax circulation email, Aussie Tourism snags Oprah, Junior MasterChef blows away the X Factor. 10 reveals next year's lineup. Classic rock fails to please in radio ratings. And Doritos picks its $30,000 ad winner. First today, we turn to Interbrand's Damien Borshok. This week sees the release, or has seen the release, of Interbrand's Best Global Brands 2010 list. Lots of famous names amongst it, Damien. Maybe just start by talking us through the methodology. How does Interbrands actually come up with this list?
Sure. The list is based on purely global brands, so they have to be brands that are based in not simply one geography, but at least 30% of their revenues have to come from other countries outside of a single geography. That's the reason why a big brand like Walmart isn't on the study, because predominantly it's a US-based brand. The methodology is based around very much the same way you would value any other asset, that we look at the economic value added that's created from the organization.
And it's the value of the brand is the important thing.
Yes, that's right. But the first place that we start is actually the earnings that an organization makes. We then determine what role brand plays in generating those earnings. And the last part of the valuation is actually understanding the level of risk that's associated with the future earning potential of that brand. And that allows us to then derive the value of the brand.
Now, looking at the values that have gone up and down since last time you did this, I was interested to notice that one of the bigger falls was Toyota.
Yes.
What was the reason for that?
This year they had, one of the largest challenges that they've had in their history, which was the recall of over 8 million automobiles. And as a result of that, that caused substantial reputation damage to the brand. I think the interesting thing about Toyota, though, is that when those large reputational effects often take place, we would normally expect to see a much larger drop. But given the long heritage that Toyota's had and being a very trustworthy brand, well regarded, actually that drop isn't as substantial as what you would see, for example, with a brand that's completely dropped off the list like BP.
So in this case, it was down from valued at something like $31 billion last year to $26 billion
That's correct.
This year, down about 16%. One other drop more, which was Harley-Davidson.
Yes.
What was the story there?
They've been in decline for a number of years now, and it's been a combination of factors that they've traded on their heritage for so long. They're really struggling to find what is the next big thing for that organization. As demographics are shifting, younger audiences aren't buying into the brand to the same degree. They've recently hired a CEO that's been fairly controversial because of to improve their financial performance, they hired somebody who was very financially orientated. But when the fans of Harley-Davidson found out that he actually didn't drive a Harley, that actually had a fairly significant impact on people's view of the business.
That's not living the brand, is it?
Absolutely, particularly not a brand like that, where you live it, you breathe it, you feel it. And if you've got a CEO who has an academic experience of the brand purely, it's not really going to do it for the fans.
And I suppose looking at the opposite in terms of growth of brands, up 37%, the biggest jump this year. Apple, the classic ones, the brand advocates do exactly that. They live the brand.
Absolutely. And I think Apple has so many fans, and they're not people that Apple have forced into that kind of experience. It's people that just love the product. And I think even with the challenges they had with the iPhone 4 launch, again, because the brand has built such a strong reputation, that was sort of a blip in a very long sort of successful history. So again, it continues to rise. I think as it heads more and more towards the living room in people's homes, I think the brand will continue to grow.
Scott Rohde, you're one of those people who lives the brand. You're sitting there looking at your script on your iPad as we speak.
Yeah, I have got a Mac Mini at home, a Mac Pro. I've got a MacBook Pro, iPad, iPhone. You know, I use Apple. I find them. They're stable systems that I've always used because they work just fine for me and they do the job that I need. So, you know, I've used PCs in the past and never found them to be that effective, and I find that Apples are. So
now, Bob, when you go into most advertising agencies, you find Macs everywhere. What about media agencies? Starcom, are you Macs or are you?
No, we're not. There are a few people who do have Macs, but no, we still have the traditional PCs. But it's interesting. I mean, Apple, no doubt, it is a brand that everybody feels they have to have one. But you do wonder now with over the next few years, you know, have they actually reached the peak? Because there's more competition coming in now. There was a lot of talk about the launch of the new Apple TV, which wasn't as well received as some other things in that as well. So they're probably going to be coming under more pressure now than they have for a long time.
I agree. I think there will be the challenge of what's the next best thing, next big thing, and they've had such a powerful pipeline for the last few years that it's hard to see sort of how far they can push that. But I think that we see weaknesses within some of the electronics manufacturers like the Sonys of the world, who are really struggling to retain ownership of the living room, and I think that's where. It's probably early days for Apple in that space still, as technology and the infrastructure still needs to be put in place effectively. But
you've also got Google moving very much into the living room.
Absolutely.
Well.
So it'll be an interesting battle to see who ultimately wins that.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Google as well, because they were up 36%. Mm. So they're now worth just a little over $43 billion is what you reckon the brand itself to be worth. What's driven that big jump this year? Because that's an even bigger jump than last time around.
Yes, I think it's Google's getting better and better at commercializing its business and finding more and more areas to actually find sources of revenue, and it's developing at a global scale very quickly. And I think as markets more and more open up to that, as online advertising becomes more and more a substantial part of organization spends, etc., Google seems to be grabbing the lion's share of that. You've got other platforms like Yahoo that are declining at the same time, and Google is pushing into new areas, you know, for example, their Android platform, etc. So those sort of things are actually providing them with a much wider opportunity for growth. And they're the technology businesses that's challenging virtually everybody at the moment.
And in fact, do you have to be a technology business to get the big growth at the moment? Because again, the third biggest, 32% growth, up to six and a bit billion, BlackBerry, another technology brand.
22 of the 100 brands are technology brands. I think technology is the industry of our age at the moment. Early 20th century, it was steel and railroads. Middle century, it was automotive and FMCG companies. Technology is the area where the growth is, and that's why those are the brands that people are spending more money with, engaging with. They're the things that improve our lives more so. Whereas, you know, FMCG brands, they've been around a long time. They're, you know, those the sort of values in those are not as powerful as they once were.
I'm surprised to see BlackBerry jumping so much. I thought I was the only person left in the world who still had a BlackBerry.
Yeah, I think BlackBerry is still, you know, the business choice of smartphone at the moment. We're seeing more and more that the iPhone is making inroads into that space. But certainly BlackBerry still has a strong legacy. It'll be interesting to see whether they can really keep that momentum in the future, though. Mm.
What do you think, BlackBerry? What's their prospects for?
Well, I've got to say, first of all, BlackBerry is one of my clients. Yes, so therefore, I would be saying that I think they've got a very strong future.
I must admit that it was a slight little trap I left there, because I was aware you did the Starcom sessions a while ago, and I was speaking to your BlackBerry client at that.
So look, I think, you know, they've actually got a very exciting future. I mean, the reality is they are moving more from just being a business, you know, phone, to actually entering the smartphone area much more as well. So I think down the space, there's a great deal of growth opportunity for BlackBerry. And it's a brand which is very well respected.
Yes.
I think certainly for business, they're still a long way ahead of anybody else. So, very, very strong future.
Scott, what did it take you to give up the iPad and go back to
I'll give up the
BlackBerry.
iPhone? No, I wouldn't do it. Sorry.
You just aren't getting emails, do you, during the day?
Yeah. I'm not a big fan of the BlackBerry. I never have been, never was. I always found it a bit too corporate. I found it a bit too kind of old design. I much prefer.
You're a journalist by background. You need a keyboard. This is what. Why
I've
I
got
can't
a keyboard.
It
it's virtual now. Come on.
Oh, come but on. Some of the new models for BlackBerry, it's a very different looking beast nowadays. Yeah. So if,
I mean,
if you want something to look nice, then you know.
Yeah, BlackBerry. I think everybody. Yeah. It's one thing I'll say about Apple is that they're a market leader for a reason.
Yes.
Everybody copies them, and then the designs that come out, you know, do something surpass
them. And people, as I say, usually copy, but it's better.
Yeah,
I mean, the funny thing about Apple is. It's not the greatest product in the world, but yet we've all been, you know, and I've got my iPhone as well.
And it's beautifully packaged.
Beautifully packaged.
Yeah,
that's the
thing. You know, that's the thing when you actually look at
it. Well, what they do, the one thing that I'll say they do better than anyone else is they have a dictatorship.
Yeah.
And that's how it gets made to that standard. Yeah. They don't like it. It's not, you know, 15 people in a room all deciding on what features it will have. Which is one of the problems that a lot of companies do.
If I wanted to have a benevolent dictator, I would probably would pick Steve Jobs, I think, as my hopefully benevolent dictator.
Yeah. But the other thing they do so well is their marketing. I mean, you go in an Apple store and people are prepared to queue for ages to be served.
Yeah.
And I just find it, I mean, I get incredibly frustrated when I've got a small problem and you've got to make an appointment, you've got to turn up and you end up waiting for another 15, 20 minutes. But the queues are huge because people have brought so much into this brand that they're prepared to put up with it.
Yeah, it's impressive. It's got that brand loyalty.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, Damien, one thing that struck me was no Australian brands at all in the top 100. I kind of looked because I wondered whether I would see Qantas there, and they obviously weren't there last year as well. But presumably, if there was an Australian brand that would have a shot, it would be Qantas.
It's with airlines. It's very difficult to tell. I mean, they're probably the hardest type of brand to value, so it'd be hard to know because they have things like frequent flyer programs. They have dedicated air routes that not necessarily every other airline can have. That makes valuing them very difficult. But in reality, Qantas is unlikely to be one of those brands that would be one of the big global brands. There's probably a couple that have a shot at it. One of them, believe it or not, would be Telstra because of its scale. It's according to our last data, it's worth about $10 billion. So it certainly would make it in on a numbers basis. The challenge there is that Telstra is not global enough, so it doesn't meet that test. Another interesting one is Billabong, which has historically been very strong globally. They have a very good business model. It's well received internationally. Their product pipeline is strong. The challenge with them is getting large enough, the big enough scale to be able to achieve, you know, probably a $4 billion plus valuation. So it's probably a few years off from that. But those are the two that sort of immediately come to mind.
And just before we wrap up on the best global brand survey, is there anything else that leaps out from it to you?
I think for me the interesting thing was the case study, I think, this year in BP, and, you know, it sort of certainly come up as probably one of the greatest case studies in greenwashing and brandwashing that we've ever seen. Mm. And it's a classic example of an organisation that makes promises and then fails to operationalise their brand. So their behaviours just don't match up, and they've been very substantially punished, and rightly so, for that.
So what do you think of? Obviously, Coca-Cola is number one again. Who do you think is the best challenger to knock it off that spot?
I suspect it's Google because it's on the rise so fast. The interesting thing about, I guess, the number two player in the list is IBM, which is rather close to Coca-Cola. It's a business-to-business brand as well, and its growth has been a little bit slower because it is an older business, but certainly it's an organisation that is a very, very powerful player.
Great. So IBM is worth about $65 billion, Coca-Cola about $70
billion. That's right.
Amazing how they've, you know, rebranded themselves. So, you know, IBM, they've changed for the times, and you know, a few years ago they were really, you know, had problems, and they've reinvented themselves. And
well, it was very much a hardware based business. Now it's the world's largest professional services firm. And they, in the mid 90s, it was making huge losses. They turned it around because they saw where the world was heading, and that the ability to be able to connect software, hardware into solutions that clients needed to actually make their businesses work better. They took a big strategic bet on that and won very significantly.
And if the trends continue, then it looks to me like in about 2 to 3 years' time, we'll see Google at number four overtake Microsoft at number three, which
absolutely
will be symbolic.
Yes. Yeah, and I think it is the changing of the guard in terms of the, I guess, consumer technology players. You're seeing a software-based company being overturned by an online-based business, and one that is certainly doesn't look like it's going to lose momentum in the near future.
Well, Damien, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Next, Fairfax's embarrassing email. An intriguing email surfaced this week on Crikey, suggesting that Fairfax's circulation numbers don't tell the whole story. Now, this is one of those stories we have to be very, very careful with for legal reasons. But what it's worth spelling out is, in all of the allegations and discussions you're about to hear, it certainly appears that Fairfax have met the rules of the Audit Bureau of Circulation, but it's just about how transparent those rules are. So with that caveat, Bob, what really seems to have happened there is that perhaps the market was unaware of the actual number of copies of, in this case, The Age, which is the Melbourne paper, were going in, potentially going to the hands of students rather than presumably richer readers. With your, you know, you have to make decisions on whether to invest on behalf of clients. What was your view when you heard this?
It's big numbers as well they're talking about, isn't it? I mean, you're right. We have to be careful about what we say regarding all of this. I think it's just, if anything, it's highlighted potentially some loopholes in, you know, the legislation where people are able to sort of sneak some additional readers in potentially. I think we need to sort of fully understand what the true impact is. It goes back, I think, to 2007 they were talking
That's
about.
That's right. The email was from 2007. Yeah. And I think what seemed to drive it was there was an internal conversation going on within Fairfax on whether they should pull out the educational supplement as a separate supplement, which they could then obviously potentially get more advertising against, you know, targeting it. But in order to do that, they'd need to make a virtue of the large number of people they're reaching, which presumably for those who don't want to reach that large number is when it becomes a turn on.
I think this all goes back again to certainly the Media Federation has been talking a long time about the way, you know, newspapers are measured, et cetera, et cetera. So it all fits in again to having a better understanding of how papers are read, what's important, what's not important. And, you know, hopefully this is just going to push that conversation further down the track.
And with an issue like this, the Media Federation, that represents most of the media agencies, the big media agencies
absolutely,
in Australia. How good are the agencies at speaking with one voice on an issue like this?
Very good. I mean, something like this is something which, as I say, makes sense that we all speak the same language. There's no reason why there should be any, you know, internal battles about that. So as a federation, I think everyone is very much behind that. So
I think there's a bigger picture involved as well, in the fact that I think newspapers have to realise that if they're going to be the ones attacking everyone, they have to hold themselves up to a higher standard of ideals. You know, and this is showcased obviously in from the UK at the moment with this whole scandal of a lot of the journalists or some of the journalists, you know, recording phone calls illegally and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I think the moment that this happens to newspapers, you know, whether if they, you know, allegedly fudge figures or if they are breaking the law to get stories, then, you know, then I think that people start to trust them less and less.
It has been fascinating watching the UK example you're talking about, where this happened some time back, but effectively just huge numbers of journalists and most of the allegations around News of the World, which is a Murdoch newspaper, were the suggestion is using PIN codes to access voicemails where the PIN code was still set to the factory setting, and huge numbers of celebrities, politicians, other kind of public figures were being accessed and stories were coming through, which obviously a massive invasion.
And
of
it wasn't even just there wasn't even just pin codes. There was other things happening as well.
Now you were a tabloid hack.
I never did anything like that.
Did
no?
you see it going on though?
Never witnessed it. I look, you know, you hear bits and bobs and you hear rumors, but I'd never witnessed. I've never heard anybody say they did it, but you know, you hear stories. You know. You frown upon it, and it's one of those things.
Yeah, this is, and obviously, it's a very different issue to what's going on with Fairfax, but certainly in terms of credibility of news.
And in the UK, the tabloid press has always been a little bit edgy anyway over there. So, not that it can be forgiven, but you're almost not surprised to hear that sort of thing was going on. But this, again, I think comes down to, you know, there has to be a better understanding of, you know, not just circulation, but readership and how people are reading, what sections, blah, blah, blah. And you know, quite honestly, if they're serious about getting this right, they've got to start looking at better, you know, reporting data.
I mean, one of the issues that strikes me as well is just in a trading relationship, there's a certain amount of trust, or there should be. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It feels to me we've talked about it a lot, so I won't do it again, but you've got online, you've got the auto-refresh issue, you've got this. It gets to the point where the trust is not there, and that's when total transparency has to come because people have blown their chance to have the trust.
Yeah.
You know, and it feels to me like we're getting close to that point, perhaps.
Hopefully we do. I mean, that's a good thing about online. It's helping push people towards that one goal.
Well, we can read more about the Fairfax story at umbrella.com.au, and we should probably just point out that Fairfax describes, Crikey, who originated the story, describes the claims as misleading and wrong. Next, we talk about Tourism Australia's Oprah Coup.
No one does surprises quite like Oprah Winfrey.
Maybe I should take all of you with me to the other side of the world.
So in something of a PR triumph, Tourism Australia will fly Oprah Winfrey and 350 fans to Australia to record a live show at the Opera House, or Oprah House, which we got the hashtag Oprah House to trend in Sydney on the day on Twitter. Now, an estimated $3 million will be spent on the 8-day trip, and taxpayers will foot a pretty hefty part of that bill, something that seems controversial in some quarters. Scott, good PR value?
Fantastic PR value. Look, God, $3 million, that's chump change, trust me. Yeah. I mean, how much did Tourism Australia get? I mean, it's astronomical amounts. The problem is here, you know, your average guy in the street looks at that and goes, $3 million? Can't believe it. That's shocking. When actually, the amount of money that Tourism Australia has, you know, that's a drop in the ocean. And to actually promote, to get the kind of PR value that this has given them, God, it's worth $100 million probably. It's I mean, Oprah's what, one of the biggest shows in American TV.
It's huge. I mean, already the publicity that this has caused is absolutely enormous. Yeah. I mean, there's not been that much talk, I imagine, globally about Australia as a destination for a long, long time. Yeah. So the $3 million, if that's what it is already paid for. Yeah. I think so.
You just pull $3 million of your advertising and you're done.
I think the scary thing is just the thought of some of those 350
Americans coming.
When you saw how they reacted in the studio.
It'll be interesting to see if they take them to Ayers Rock or wherever they take Uluru, as it's called now.
Yeah, yeah.
Or wherever they take them, you know, it's going to be interesting to actually see what because the press are going to follow these 350 people like nothing on earth.
There is no person who's as influential as Oprah in the world of TV.
Which is terrifying.
It is on many different levels, but it's why not take advantage of it?
I suppose it's not without its risks as well, because if she doesn't have a good time if one of her 350 guests get mugged or something, you know, there's potential for backlash as well.
No, there is. Fortunately, it's her last series, so she won't be back to say. Yeah. But no, look, I think, you know, the worst thing potentially will be it will be pouring down with rain when they're sitting there at the Oprah House and everyone will say, I thought Australia was beautiful and sunny. I think it's going to be, the hype is going to be absolutely enormous.
Yeah,
and as I say, whether you like it or not, it's for tourism, it's going to be.
It's funny, somebody I noticed somebody posted on Umbrella about from another website saying they had a story running about how Oprah, when she gave everybody the cars, that she gave everybody a Pontiac, I think it was, it's worth $30,000. But they all had to pay the $8,000 tax.
That's right.
And she paid a part of it. But then other people were like, oh, where's my money? Free car? Oh, no, not really. So do they have to pay the tax on the trip to Australia?
That's perhaps some people might see as a side issue. But it's good that you always consider the tax implications.
There you go.
I suppose the other potential winner for this is Ten, who've got the rights to the Oprah show.
Very happy to talk about it last night, weren't they? Their launch,
They certainly were. And of course, you know, usually it goes out as a sort of lunchtime slot.
Yeah.
But presumably we'll see that prime time.
Yeah. Well, I've got to say, you know, within our office, all the girls are saying, how can we get to the show, you know, at the Opera House? I mean, there is going to be
Masses of crowds.
A lot of interest.
I find it funny you say that, Tim, there. I mean, if she does come here, and you're going to have, how many people around that area in Circular Quay? And it's going to be terrifying as a normal tourist if they turn up at that time. And, you know, that might be a little bit of negative brand image, because you turn up, there's just millions of people in Circular Quay, you're like, I can't even see the Opera House.
Well, that's true. Yeah, no, I think there have to be some serious crowd management, you know, sort of, you know, having it almost.
I imagine she comes with her own army, doesn't she?
I think she's got an entourage,
Well, we stick with 10 next. Forget Senior MasterChef. It's all about Junior MasterChef. So in television this week, Ten's Junior MasterChef launched on Sunday to a staggering, to me, certainly 2.2 million viewers, the highest MasterChef debut ever. Now, Bob, I took my guess beforehand. I thought I was being pretty generous. I guessed 1.8 million. You know, well over that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we'll talk about the 10 up front, but I talked to somebody reasonably senior from 10 who'd been betting on 1.5 million.
Yeah,
so it's a pleasant surprise for them. What were you anticipating?
Look, I think anything over 1.5 we would have thought would have been good for Sunday night against the X Factor, et cetera, et cetera. But look, I think the way they've promoted this, I think a lot of interest was shown when they put the YouTube, you know, promo on, et cetera, et cetera. One of the reasons apparently they brought the show forward as well, because the response was so good.
And that's one thing I do wonder, actually, is because, yeah, they got the excitement and they now launched very, very well. The reason they were going to put it off was because of the Commonwealth Games. Now they're going to have to break it halfway through the series. Mm. Will that build anticipation?
I think potentially it will. Look, I think, again, the difference between this and the traditional MasterChef, it's once a week. So, again, you know, you've got to keep the excitement every week for people to come back. But whether you know, whatever you might think of it, they do it very well. Having watched it myself, you ended up going, actually, they're not bad, these kids at cooking. And it's a well-put-together, good-looking show and an opportunity for families to all get together. And I think that's the thing. People want an excuse to sit down as a family and watch good, feel-good TV. And this is what this show's given.
And do you think this is what's really hurt the X Factor? Because on the Sunday night show, it really does seem to have struggled as a result. Mm.
Oh, look, I think so. I think, you know, again, the seven executives would have said they were very nervous about MasterChef starting. They wanted X Factor, I think, to have got off to a stronger start beforehand. So I think they were a bit concerned it wasn't doing as well even before last Sunday. But look, you know, X Factor's a different discussion, I think. It's one of those shows that...
last week's show with Chris Stevenson from PhD, and we had a discussion afterwards, after the show, about the X Factor. Where, you know, the general agreement was that it's marketed wrong over here.
Mm. Well, he made the point that what he would do if he had his hands on it was, and this was, as you say, the conversation that happened off air because we were running a bit short of time, but he was making the point that it should be far more about the judges.
Yeah.
And they almost want their own producer assigned to them to create some stories around them.
You know, I hate to admit this, but I am a big X Factor UK fan, and this time of the year I drive everybody mad in the office because I say, have you seen this on YouTube? But the show is about the judges, whether you like it or not, and the talent is quite good as well. But, you know, Simon Cowell and Cheryl, you know, and all that sort of thing, it's about the relationship between all the judges. The hype over there is absolutely huge, and the way the media get behind the show, where every single tabloid newspaper is talking about the X Factor before it's even begun, it's just big business.
Massive.
The whole thing.
And over here,
in this market, it's not. And with all due respect, you know, the judges should be quite good.
Yeah.
But it doesn't appear to be gelling. And I think one of the problems that hit the show was the fact that Matt Newton had to be edited out of the earlier shows. And part of the success in the UK is all the interaction again with the host talking to the contestants. All of that was taken out. So I think it's lost its...
I mean, I got sent some from the UK. I got sent one of the X Factor videos from the UK with the two young girls, best friends, and I'm fighting on stage and punching each other. You know, and it's just massive.
It is viral.
I guess it'll be when Australia's first X Factor viral moment happens.
Yeah, and look, I think as they get into the live shows, the potential is going to be that much greater again. But Sundays, I think it will struggle against MasterChef.
Well, still with TV, this week saw 10 unveil its new lineup. We were there, we had a chat with David Mott. Let's hear what he had to say about some of the forthcoming stuff.
Hello, I'm Tim Burrows. Here we are at the Network 10 2011 Upfronts presentation in Sydney. David, let's start by talking about some of the programme coming up for 2011.
Yep.
I guess one of the biggest investments will be the renovators. What are your hopes for that?
Well, clearly I want it to work. I think clearly we actually look for the next big genre, and we actually felt that's a world that hasn't really been tapped into yet. Obviously the cooking shows, there's been a lot of great lifestyle renovation shows, but we want to bring it up another level. And so we've been searching for the right format. We spoke to the guys at Shine, the guys that created MasterChef, and we said, you know what, let's talk about this. And they came up with the renovators. And we think it's going to be unlike anything anyone else has ever seen before. Let's face it, everyone goes, you know, your home is your castle. And so we think at the moment, everyone goes to the homemaker sales, they go to IKEAs and places like that. So we're tapping into the heart of Australia. that feels that there's something very strong about the place that they live in. So we think it's going to be the next big genre.
So did you see, you were at the 10 Upfronts launch as I was, Bob. It was a big night, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. You got to hand it to them. They do put on a good show.
They certainly do. Yes, I was at the Foxtel launch a few weeks ago, and I thought that was all singing, all dancing. Yeah. But yeah, the
I think they actually moved the Ivy from the Ivy to.
Yeah, it's funny you just said that, Bob. They put on a good show, but they don't put on good shows.
Oh, come on, dear me!
But no, it was. You know, they took over the Hall of Industries in Sydney, and they've been doing similar events around the rest of the capital cities as well. So you know, you walk into this hall, and there's just. It looks like they've hired in every single sofa in the city.
The lounge room came to the
city. They just go to IKEA and say, we'll have them all.
It did. Well, exactly. It must have been, you know, right down to the standard lamps and everything. So, you know, it was a very slick presentation.
Yeah.
You looked around and you saw most media agencies represented there. So it was a big presentation.
I think the expectation now is that 10 put on a very good launch show. And I think, you know, they have gone early this year, and that is, I think, in recognition of the fact that they're very confident about their product for 2011. So they've gone out to the market early saying, look, we know what we're going to do. We don't have to wait to show you. This is what we're going to do.
Well, I guess three standouts for me are things that they were talking big about. The one that most surprised me from seeing the sizzle reel, having written about it a day or two before, was Class Of.
Yeah.
What did you make of that?
I actually think it looks good. I again was very surprised as to what I thought it was going to be, but I think again if they get the right talent and you know they do it in the way that they are very good at doing that style of show, I think it could have quite a big impact.
And the idea being they take a failing class of kids, they put the best educationalists they can find with them, and spend a year turning them around and follow them through until they get their results.
Now if that sort of show's done in the wrong way and it becomes a bit, you know, schmaltzy and a bit whatever, it's not good. But I think the history that 10 have got of creating those sort of shows, I think the potential is very, very strong. And I heard a lot of very positive talk about that, to be honest. And it was the show that people weren't expecting to be a big show, to be honest.
And what about the renovators? That's when they're investing in big, Shine are making it.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It feels, on first look, it feels a bit like The Block.
Block on steroids, I think. Yeah. No, I think that was the question that we kind of asked 10 as well. So the difference between that and The Block, and I think that the fact is it's big. It's bigger than anything else that they've ever done. Again, Shine, you know, making MasterChef, they know how to do these shows very well. It's going to be based more around challenges as opposed to just renovating a house. So a lot of competition and the opportunity for people to win big money as well, live auction at the end of the day, et cetera, et cetera. So, look, this is a big show. And again, I think just the way they presented it, you got the impression that it's big.
And the one that feels to me more like a gamble is Don't Stop Believing.
Yes. Well, again, you know, that was all the singing and dancing at the end of the evening, and it looked fantastic. And at the end of all of that, we said, but what's the show about? You know,
and they've described it as reality glee. Or
exactly. So they're playing. Oh, no. So you'll be watching it every week. Yeah. Let me tell you. But look, the format didn't work in the UK, so they've adapted it over here, which again they've proved they can do. MasterChef, they adapted that from the UK version and was hugely successful. So, look, again, there's this feel good factor at the moment. Glee is very big over here, whether you like it or not.
Don't.
Why am I surprised? Gosh, that's shocking. So I think it's going to be interesting to watch that one. But again, they're going to put a lot of money behind it. So,
well, next we look at the winners and losers in the radio ratings. So in radio this week, the moment that I think every program controller dreads when the numbers come in, Classic Rock, which is DMG's relatively recent relaunch, we're probably two or three ratings periods in there. Now that's actually slipped down in the ratings again. In Sydney in particular, it's faded to about 2.6. And I think it depends on whether you look at the 5-day Monday to Friday or the Sunday, but something of that sort of that ilk. Does it just demand a bit of patience, do you think, or is there a bigger problem?
Look, these numbers came out just before they launched the new campaign for Classic Rock. It's a tough market, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot of rock stations around there.
I've changed to Classic Rock now. That's the one I listen to. On the way here, I had Pink Floyd's Time playing. I was like, brilliant, just nice.
I think people need to find it. I mean, I've got a 16-year-old son, and he loves it. and it's one of his favourite stations as well. So the opportunity for it is quite good.
Yeah.
The problem is in Sydney, you need a strong breakfast show as well. And at the moment, breakfast obviously isn't a big area for them. They need to sort of build on that, but I think you have got to give it time. They're committed to it.
Well, they have the presenter-less breakfast. Yeah. And I suppose part of it might be they've got Paul Jackson coming in as the new sort of programme director from the UK.
Yeah.
It would seem a bit odd to make any big decisions until he gets here. Yeah. So maybe it's kind of a holding pattern. Yeah.
Look, Alice Cooper at nighttime is brilliant. His DJing stint he does on the show is superb.
Yeah, it's like the Absolute Radio stuff he does.
Yeah. It's a syndicated show.
Right, okay.
I was listening to it last night and he was making a joke about how he said he gave up, he said Mick Jagger, I think, gave up booze for women, but he gave Alice Cooper gave up drugs for golf.
That's the sad thing that Alice Cooper plays golf now.
I know, he said that.
Like, what happened?
All he does is rip the piss out of himself through the whole show. It's really good.
Yeah.
Now, a couple of others that leapt out at me. Firstly, from Sydney, WSFM is sneaking up, isn't it?
Look, they have been the quiet achievers for a number of years, actually. Mm. So I'm not surprised to see that. Look, they do it very well. And again, I think, you know, they're very strong out west, obviously, but they're doing a good show. Their breakfast show, again, it's very good.
Yeah.
Good talent.
It's about the best there is. I mean, the two of them, they work well together, you know, they gel. The jokes they do.
Probably the longest serving breakfast team now, I think, in Sydney. But
and I think Amanda's the linchpin to it.
She's
as well.
Great. Yeah.
And then one other to look at is, it seemed like an expensive investment in the time over in Melbourne, but Eddie Maguire for Triple M is finally delivering some numbers for them after, must be a year or coming up for a year that he's been doing that. Do you think that sort of investment can pay off? Because clearly he won't come cheap.
No. Look, I think so. Again, you know, I hate the fact on here we quite often talk about the UK, but, you know, if you look at the success of a radio station like Radio 2, it's all built on big personalities.
Which is the BBC.
Absolutely, yeah. So I think, you know, Eddie in Melbourne is such a big personality that I think it was only a matter of time before people found him and felt comfortable with what he's doing on Triple M. And, you know, he's got to make money somehow these days, hasn't he? Because he's not on TV much, is he?
Well, coming up next, we'll hear what happens when the amateurs make the ads.
My name's Dennis, and I'm Australian. I've got an Australian flag in my room. My best mate's name's Davo. It's a very Australian name. I've got a ute. The antenna on my ute is shaped like Australia. Yeah! I like watching sport when Australia's playing. And I really like eating Doritos because
they're Tasmanian.
Yeah.
Doritos. It would be un-Tasmanian not to.
So that clip you heard was the winner for Doritos Make an Ad, Make a Fortune competition. That's Aussie-loving Dennis. Now, it sometimes feels to me as if every single time you get a big brand, the strategy ends up being run some sort of competition for somebody to make an ad.
Saves them from giving money to a production house.
Well, I suppose it does, doesn't it? Is this becoming a bit of a crowded-out idea now, do you think, Will?
Yeah, but the truth is there's a lot of people out there who want to make ads. So that's the thing, is you're still going to get people wanting to do it. And so as long as you're going to get enough interest, people will put their hands up and say, give me a go.
How many kids are running? I mean, our iPhones are shooting 720p at the moment. You know, getting a high-def camera is not an issue. If you can edit, you know, you can put something together. You just look at, I mean, this advert here, you know, it's really well put together. The guy's obviously done the rounds on short film festivals and all that kind of stuff, but you know, he's got good skills. And
21-year-old, I tell you what, winning 30 grand at 21 probably goes quite a long way, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
So, good stuff for him. Yeah. Well, look, that's all we have time for today. So thank you to my co-host, Scott Rohde.
Thanks, Tim.
And to our guest, Starcom's Bob Gooch.
Thanks very much.
And Interbrand's Damien Borchuk. Thanks also to CBS for use of their studios. Production was by Georgina Pearson. That was the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Toodle-pip.